Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:04 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is March 2nd, today being Friday. It's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. It's been quite eventful. In the precious metals, gold went almost as high as $1,800, pulled back very sharply on Wednesday, and finished out the week in the region of $1,712, so the range on the week was more than $100. It's a large downside key reversal. More on that in a moment. Oil was also very volatile. There was a rumor yesterday that there was an explosion at a pipeline in Saudi Arabia. Prices tacked on an additional $3 or $4. They gave up much of that today, as it was just a rumor, and prices are stable in the region of $120 on Brent crude, in the region of $106 for West Texas Intermediate. Equity markets were generally steady during the week. They're finishing out the week down just a tad on Wall Street, up just a tad in most of Europe. The majority of Asia was really quite steady, and a number of markets pushed on to new high ground. Thailand was notable in that regard. It's joined a small club of countries and indices that have pushed onwards to new highs since the August pullback. That's generally a rather bullish sign. We're not seeing too many markets pushing on to new lows. The Saudi Arabian market was also interesting this week in that it pushed above the 7,000 area for the first time since 2008. That's a significant new recovery high there. In the sovereign bond markets, US Treasuries, you had a contract change, and there's a bit of a gap on the price chart, but it went back down to test the lower side of its range. It's bounced in there today. It's up 26 ticks. It's back above 141. It's been ranging now in this sort of tight fashion for the last almost between 3 and 4 months. It's been in the region of the 140 to 105 area for almost 6 or 7 months. Eurobunds had a particularly strong week, and they're finishing out the week close, if not at a new high, very close to a new high at 140.06. Europe this week had some pretty eventful news. You had the ECB moving in to lend an additional 530 billion euro to the banking sector. Part of the reason they've been doing that is to recapitalize the banks. They've additionally incentivized the banks to go out and buy sovereign bonds by lowering the collateral requirements at the ECB. This allows the banks to borrow at remarkably low rates from the ECB, go out and buy bonds at below par, post them as collateral with the ECB at par, take out additional loans at very low levels, go out and buy more bonds, and the cycle repeats. And they get to pick up the arbitrage. What happened this week is that there's a clear divergence between the bonds of Spain, Italy, France, Belgium, and Austria, and a number of other northern European countries, and those of Greece and Portugal in particular, and potentially Ireland. The spread over bunds for the first group contracted sharply following the lending of the additional 530 billion euros, suggesting additional demand for those bonds relative to bunds. But Greek spreads pushed higher. Portuguese spreads, having contracted quite impressively from the end of January, not least because of additional buying, rallied this week from 1,000 to 1,200 basis points, suggesting that the ECB's bond buying program, which has been on hiatus since they started lending out to the banking sector, may have to be reactivated if they want to avoid a disorderly situation in Portugal, because sovereign spreads up there at 1,000 basis points are uncomfortable. There hasn't been a great deal of focus on the Portuguese economy, but the rate at which their bonds are currently trading at isn't particularly encouraging. The fact that Ireland has chosen to go the referendum route would suggest that the additional sense of uncertainty there will, at a minimum, curtail the ability of those spreads to contract further, and they could widen in this environment. The US dollar has also firmed quite considerably this week against the euro and against the yen. Against the euro, it was close to 135 at the end of last week. It's finishing out this week at 132, almost even. So it's fallen 3 cents in the last week. The yen also continues to weaken. The dollar was higher than 82 yen at one point this week. It's finishing out the week at 81.77. The Bank of Japan announced an inflation target in the last couple of weeks, and they seem to be finally beginning to take seriously the need to bring down the value of their currency. So you have two of the largest central banks in the world pumping liquidity like there's no tomorrow. Part of the reason that we had such incredible volatility in stock markets, particularly in the last half of last year, was because there was this high degree of uncertainty as to what the ECB were going to do. Since December, we know what the answer to that question is. They've stepped in as the lender of last resort. They're expanding the size of their balance sheet. They've lent €1 trillion to the European banking sector, and they're going to continue lending for as long as it takes to get the result that they want. They need to recapitalize the banking sector. The release of the latest tranche of the Greek bailout bought some time. The fact that you have this divergence in the direction with which the spreads are moving in Europe suggests that the Greek situation is still very much in play. The Portuguese situation is also a center for uncertainty. So those are two potential problems that are out there, but the ECB is much more active now. So their capacity to shock the market, to continue to contribute to the volatility that was so debilitating to sentiment, has decreased since December. That's what's helped to fuel the impressive rallies that we've seen in so many of these stock markets. The oil price is at an uncomfortably high level. It also represents a threat, as it's been rallying at least in part because of concerns about Iran, but probably more because of the amount of liquidity hitting the market. And the problem with that is that high oil prices may be a boon for speculators, but they have very real-world consequences. And to our mind, high oil prices represent the most credible threat to the cyclical bull market that got going back in October. When we take a step back and we look at the big picture, we've had some interesting developments in Asia. China is trying its best to come in with a soft landing for the property market. Those are notoriously difficult to engineer. If they're going to succeed, then they need to start easing, and they need to start easing reasonably quickly. They can pretty safely now claim success in pricking the housing bubble. They need to start lowering reserve requirements, easing the restrictions on buying homes, building more homes, and perhaps, making the Hukou system of registration a bit more flexible. If one of the things that has happened in China over the last few years is that the benefit that they get from a dollar invested in infrastructure is now outpaced by the amount of benefit they get from investing in healthcare or the social safety net. What you're seeing in some cities is that they are now giving some of the migrant workers greater access to healthcare and social security and education for their children than they would have had previously. The hukou system in China keeps people very much tied to where they were born, and it's not so much difficult to move to another city, but it's difficult to be accepted as a resident in some of those cities. So it's been a very difficult environment for the 300 million people that are classed as migrant workers. The fact that you're now getting some cities beginning to relax their attitude to those types of people should help the consumer economy, because migrant workers have previously had to save more than anyone else in a high savings environment. Those types of moves should help to bolster the consumer economy. China needs to improve its consumer economy. It needs that extra strut to its arsenal. It has the powerful manufacturing base. It has relied on infrastructure development for growth. It needs the consumer economy to give balance to the strengths that its economy has, particularly as the requirement for significantly more infrastructure declines over time. China still lags behind what are considered developed economies in per capita consumption of commodities. It has 1 billion people, so it's going to lag behind other countries on a per capita basis for a significant amount of time. It's already the largest consumer of steel in the world and a number of other commodities. That's unlikely to change, because the infrastructure development has been impressive. It's not about to evaporate, but the focus is likely to change toward supporting the consumer. The Chinese are attempting to sell a version of the American dream to their people, and that very much centers on a bargain that the Communist Party will supply an improving standard of living for the majority of people in return for power. Now, when we contrast that with India, it's rather the opposite, because the consumer economy in India is quite developed. The corporate sector in India is quite developed, and you have a number of Indian companies have embarked onto the world stage and dominate their respective niches. You have very high standards of corporate governance. What you don't have is infrastructure. And it is interesting that now you are starting to get some movement on that front. The Indians are setting aside money to go out and secure resources for their medium to long-term development. And they're starting to think with a more organized plan on how they're going to develop their domestic infrastructure and release some of the bottlenecks. Now, these developments are important because they're helping to back up what's happening in the stock market. China has had its biggest rally in over a year. It's pressuring the progression of lower rally highs. It's pushing back above the 200-day moving average for the first time in quite some time. Valuations are at attractive levels. They're at areas on a PE basis where significant rallies have begun in the past, and you are getting the potential for an easing of policy if they want to secure the soft landing that they desire so badly. India has got a pretty unique exposure to high oil prices. The comparative strength of the rupee over the last few months should help to moderate that pressure. What we have seen in the stock market is that it's also had its biggest rally in more than a year. It's being led higher by the banking sector. The consumer sectors are already starting to hit new highs, and the cement sector in particular has been among the leaders. There's only one reason that cement leads, and that's infrastructure. So that's a bellwether for the Indian market. There's an increasing likelihood that the market has bottomed and that it is going to push on to new high ground. I've concentrated on China and India because they represent two of the larger population centers, and they're some of the fastest growing. But Asia is a hotbed of GDP growth and improving standards of governance. And you're seeing that the ASEAN region in particular is leading to the upside. It's a temporal leader in that it is breaking upwards to new high grounds early. It's moving into corrective phases early. It's also among some of the better relative performers. That's what we characterize as a leadership role. They're worth watching from that perspective alone. But what's happening in China and India and most of Asia, and indeed right across Latin America, where you've seen that Latin American markets have returned to a position of outperformance, suggests that whereas there's a great deal of navel-gazing going on in Europe and in the USA, the rest of the world is getting on with business as usual. And we're seeing that the greatest urbanization in history is helping to bolster the standard of living right across the world. It's also helping to bolster trade between emerging markets. And that's likely to continue to become a developing theme over the coming years. Now, we've talked a lot over the last year, and particularly over the last few months, about US energy independence. Natural gas is cheap. And when you have a cheap, abundant commodity where supply is secure, people come up with new uses for it. And natural gas is cheap because it's now competitive with coal. And it's displacing coal in power stations. That's important because the USA has abundant resources. When we contrast the USA with Europe, Europe has gone the austerity route. They've been concentrating on moral hazard. They don't want to have core countries bailing out irresponsible peripheral countries. So they've enforced austerity. They're pretty thin with a growth strategy. And that's their great weakness. The USA, on the other hand, went and did the opposite. It printed money like there was no tomorrow, and it started that process very early. So you're now starting to see that the USA is starting to grow once more. You've had a massive socialization of debt in both cases. The USA still has to grasp the nettle in terms of austerity. It needs to find some way to curtail spending and to raise revenues. That almost certainly means more taxes. But in an economy which is beginning to grow, that's less of an issue than it would be in a region where you have a number of economies still in recession. The prospect of energy independence makes the growth story a bit more compelling. It also makes the really quite large challenges that need to be met in terms of the unfunded deficits, or the unfunded liabilities and the deficits, a bit easier to tackle. So we've characterized Wall Street as being in a secular bear market for the last decade. That was a generational-long period of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. That process isn't over yet. The prospect of energy independence is out there in the future. It can be grasped with the right set of policies, but it's still an uncertainty. the fact that the economics are very much in its favor does make it more of a probability than a possibility. So we are in a transition. When we look at the bond markets, sovereign yields are at incredibly low levels. And they're at such low levels because governments have been buying their own paper and investors have been only too willing to participate. But most of the reason has been because governments have been terrified about deflation. They've been faced with a declining velocity of money, and velocity of money has been declining in the USA since, for at least the last decade, I think since 1997. So the credit bubble developed to counteract that. It wasn't as noticeable because that velocity of money was requiring more and more capital to keep the economy on an even keel. We're in a deleveraging process. That's going to take time above all else. But if growth does start to pick back up and deflation becomes less of a fear, which is probably likely over the next 5 to 10 years, then the prospect of such risible yields, where we have negative real interest rates in not just in the sovereign bonds, but in a host of other asset classes, investors aren't going to stick around for that. So the greatest urbanization in history that's driving secular bull markets in Asia is going to attract more attention. Gold had a big pullback this week. $100 range on in the price, and from a region of previous resistance, is a big hit in 1 week. It does suggest that gold has hit a peak of near-term significance. It's now in the region of $1,700, which offered support back in September. It's above the 200-day moving average, which is in the region of $1,650. It really does need to hold in this area if the medium-term upside is to continue to be given the benefit of the doubt. If you see it pushing back below the 200-day moving average, then the prospect of it pulling right back towards the reaction lows is really quite a bit more realistic. Gold is hard money. And with central banks continuing to abuse their fiat currencies, massively increasing the supply of money in an effort to compensate for the contraction in the velocity of money, they ignore the fact that capital flows toward the most productive asset or the asset that has the better yield. And people have less faith in something that can just be printed into existence. So whereas gold has pulled back, and whereas this week's downward dynamic and key reversal are debilitating to sentiment, there isn't a great deal of evidence yet that the secular bull market is over. Higher interest rates have killed off just about more bull markets than anything else, but that's particularly the case for gold because it doesn't have any yield. And we're still in a position where we have negligible interest rates spread across a whole range of countries. That's unlikely to change anytime soon. So gold is prone to volatility, and it remains for the bulls to prove their case at present. But it would need significant additional deterioration to really question the secular bull market in the asset class. The US dollar needs to be compared with a whole host of currencies. It's particularly strong against the euro and the yen. when one compares it with Asian currencies or Latin American currencies, then its performance isn't nearly as impressive. So right now, it's a middle-of-the-road currency. When one looks at the US economy, it's performing better than Europe. It's probably performing a bit better than Japan. It's not performing nearly as well as Asia or Latin America. And that's probably reflected in the currency. You could, I think, deem the currency at the moment to be a middle-of-the-road currency. The USA still has significant problems ahead of it. And the dollar, when one looks at the dollar index, has been in a base formation for much of the last 3 or 4 years. When one looks at the last 40 or 50 years, I think it's not unfair to say that the dollar is like an oil tanker. It takes a long time to turn, and major tops and bottoms have taken a significant amount of time, and that looks to be the case in here again. The euro has encountered resistance this week in the region of $1.35. It does look like it's going to move lower in here. The Europeans need a weaker currency. In the competitive world of globalization, there's nobody wants a particularly strong currency, but some do need a weaker currency more than others. And right now, that's Europe and Japan. The Europeans definitely need a weaker currency, and the Japanese have recently come around to the same notion. The adoption of an inflation target by the Bank of Japan is a catalyst for the stock market. We've been saying for a number of years that the Japanese needed a weaker yen to excite investor interest in the market. We're beginning to see that. The banking sector is outperforming. The small cap sector is outperforming. And we're seeing an increasing number of equities breaking up out of multi-year bases. That's all supportive of a recovery trajectory. So Japan has been off the radar for really quite a long time. And it would appear to be becoming back into fashion, particularly now that the Bank of Japan does look to have some credibility in its efforts to weaken the yen. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening. I wish all the best to all of you.